Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host
Jonah Falcon.
Time to do our vocal exercises. No, I was kidding.
Sounded sexy.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 186. I am your host, Madjin, and as usual, I am joined by my co-host, Daniel Quick.
Plus one, you like the sound of your own voice. Plus two, when someone says they like the sound of your voice as well.
Ah, weirdo. Makalua?
How did I pull that one out? That was just weird.
The me and team?
Plus three, the Mian Team soft, soothing voice.
Alrighty then. And we are joined by guest host Jonah Falcon.
Stop, you're interrupting my game of Pandemic here. Oh, I'm on the podcast. Hello.
Fine, we took drug fill away from Call of Duty, I'm sure.
I'm playing with six epidemic cards, baby.
Ooh. Get lag compensated.
Is anybody here play the board game Pandemic?
I've played it.
Okay. I guess I'm a Pandemic fan. But anyways, we're talking about Civilization here. There are no Pandemics in Civilization, although there should be.
Well, we more or less talk about Civilization, and then when we edit it, it's mostly about Civilization at that point. Well, we're specifically when Dan edits it, because he's awesome, and he gets plus two for his voice. I'll give him a plus two.
Thanks, Phil. I appreciate that.
Well, Pandemic is about Civilization collapsing.
I was going to say there was a Black Plague event in Civ 4, but that wasn't fun.
That's because of what the way it was implemented, not necessarily because of its existence in general sense.
Yes, because, you know, the Black Plague, it was fun some other time.
Wait a minute. Didn't they have the Eco-Terrorist in Test of Time or something like that?
Thinking of Call of Power.
Oh, Call of Power. That's right. Yeah. Didn't they have an Eco-Terrorist and all those weird units?
Yes.
Okay. So there you go.
A televangelist.
they're called missionaries in Civ 5.
No, actually, I think you're thinking of Great Prophets. That's about the level of annoyance.
Speaking of annoyance, the Vitagarians. No, wait.
That uprising, that was always fun. Not so, Dan, is the thing about this little language update, you're happy that traditional Chinese is not supported?
No, I'm happy about the corrected a multiplayer exploit that could allow humans to steal other humans' tradable items.
Yeah.
Love the language update. We shall cleanse the cursives in the game between players.
I like how it was phrased as a language update, because I think most people would see the thread and go, oh, I'm not going to click and read that. But in a language update, we're removing the ability of humans to steal other human tradable items. Yeah, that sounds like language.
And corrected some multiplayer lobby issues and fixed some issues with the Pit Boss server. It is a language. It might not be a natural language.
It certainly produces some language.
Indeed.
A couple of issues came up in this thread. One noticed that, hey, our dedicated Pit Boss server is kicking players from the game the moment they join and replacing them with AI players. So you go ahead, you close the Pit Boss server, you make sure your software development kit updates, you verify local file cache, you start the new Pit Boss server, and load your save game. And oh, if people are now trying to join, like a local area network game, and one of them connects under their Steam community nickname now, but in the save they loaded with their real name, this is from Elite P, what do you do? Razor Race, who is Bradley Olson at Firaxis, responsible for a lot of these multiplayer changes, says just load the save game and stay at the staging room. Kick the affected players from the game. Have them rejoin, and if they are in the wrong sieve, use the swap player slot buttons. Only launch the game once everyone is in the correct slots. Now, strictly speaking, Bradley, that last statement does not have to be true if you want to troll people, but okay.
I was in first place, I'm in last now. What happened? Oh, we accidentally put you in the wrong sieve. Let's see if you can win now.
Why was your luck skill in rejoining the lobby so bad?
He didn't put enough points into it.
Someone else had a greater hammer overflow than you, so they got it instead. Uh-huh.
By the way, from now on, every time I'm next door with the Mongols, I'm just restarting.
Just rush them.
They're not that bad.
No, well, I leave them alone for like a few turns, and suddenly they have hordes of catapults and spearmen. It's like, what?
Declare war on them right away.
Maybe, but I think it's just faster to reset.
There are city-states nearby. You probably want to do something about the Mongols sooner rather than later.
Yes, kill the city-states before they get there.
That's one approach.
You're saving the city-states from the Mongols.
Exactly. And then you're saving the Mongols from themselves. It makes perfect sense.
You have to have an intervention. Genghis, we have to talk about all your conquering.
Genghis, your head is too attached to your body.
This is an email from the Greasy Dave. Basically, his email reads, "Hi, I've recently become an avid listener to your podcasts. Thank you for that. I don't know how often you discuss questions by listeners, but I thought we'd write and ask anyway." Well, we're discussing it! Basically, he writes, he's curious to know our take on war in Brave New World. He finds war in the early game more difficult, and domination victories also more difficult. And the two chief headaches he gets are the negative diplo modifier one gets for declaring war on other civilizations, and the subsequent difficulties trading those luxury resources. He also has trouble with the tech hit from every city. He also notes the AI being smarter since the patch, which might be true, but it's all relative. And it's putting together better combos of units, so that's slowing him down a bit as well. And he would like to hear basically our take on this.
It's actually common sense. I mean, come on. How often do luxuries go up when a nation is at war? I mean, there's something I like to call rationing that happens when a nation is at war, you know? I mean,
who rations luxuries? Come on. That's usually handled by the market anyway. But if you're destroying some of them, then yeah.
Some nations may not want to trade with you when you're at war either. As a matter of fact, they might just want to steal from you.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much what happens in Civ. And I like that Civ 5 made war more difficult, because previous Civs, and that means every Civ I've seen or played, essentially it was a war game with some features thrown on the side. As soon as you had a tech lead and a power lead, yeah, you could find other ways to win. But in a game between two people who know what they're doing, military survival is first and foremost, always. And that's not the case anymore. They've actually balanced it so it's a lot more challenging of a victory condition to win. And I would argue that's a good thing. But yeah, it's certainly harder.
Yeah.
Well, on the first point where he talks about the negative diplomatic modifiers one racks up after declaring war on a civilization, seriously hurting the player's ability to trade the luxury he wins through conquest. First off, it sounds like you're probably getting a lot of them that really don't tolerate warmongers very much. And it certainly starts to add up as time goes on. But quite honestly, if you can't trade them because they won't give you anything for it, and you have all these extras, why don't you just go ahead and gift it to them? I'm not saying it's going to completely negate the negative, but at least give them something positive to think about. Hey, stop warring with that person. It's mean. Don't do that. Well, I happen to have an extra luxury. Do you want to trade something? No. Well, let me just give it to you just because I can. Aw, gee gosh, golly, thanks.
Based on your knowledge of who is more or less tolerant of you slaughtering everybody, such that the people who you aren't killing currently are more tolerant of war than the people that you are, that will allow you to help out your deals a little bit. So if you pick your targets, then the amount of time before everyone in the world hates you is extended, and that should make it a little bit easier.
And if the person who really doesn't like warmongering, unless they are able to do something to you, either because they're able to attack you or they're able to rally other people to the cause to try to say, hey, let me bribe you into going to war with this person because you can actually reach them. Or a little later on, you know, once you get the World Congress and start blocking you and ganging up on you, you got to gauge the field, as it were. Because if someone really isn't going to be that much of a problem, and the fact that they really hate you, you can just let them, you know, go screaming and bitching in a corner and you can just ignore it.
Well, one of the things you have to worry about is you don't get to find out who hates warmongering until you start it. Plus, your friends tend not to hate on you for warmongering too quickly, unless, of course, you just wiped out everybody. But you do get to find out who's got how much, well, at least now with the latest patch, how much warmonger hate you're going to pick up.
Well,
so,
I thought that the civilizations have set personalities and you have to toggle them to be random.
There's the flavor system, which sets certain numbers on a scale of 1 to 10 as default, but it always adjusts by plus or minus 2 every time you start a game. So you could have a situation where somebody who normally hates warmongers just gets pulled down a little bit more.
Because they're being a warmonger too?
Yeah, there's that too. Get some friends before you start wiping out the planet and then kill them later. It also means that you may want to, for the domination victory, just focus on the capitals rather than a complete wipeout, and you might not take as much negative diplo for killing somebody.
It's funny, you know, I find the easiest win condition right now is the cultural victory, you know, with everybody loading my blue jeans and my rock music. I mean, usually it's a race between me and the guy who's AI who's trying to win the world leader thing, you know, win all the votes in the World Congress. Usually that's when I have to go warmongering just to kill him before he can get that vote.
I mean, otherwise, try not to get too many people mad at you.
At least not at once. That can do something about it.
Yeah, not all at the same time. Especially if they have a bigger military than you.
The longer you have before you draw a world ire, the more capable you are of simply beating everyone down now that they hate you.
Yeah. Well, I find getting the World War I cavalry before everybody else is a big help. I mean, that's kind of some kind of leap there. I mean, whatever that unit is.
He has Great War Infantry?
I think he has a 50 attack, and the next lowest is something like 25 or 30 at best.
You know? Yeah, that's roughly the point in the tech tree where unit stats just start jumping.
Yeah. If you're ahead of other people and you get that unit, you might as well just wipe the mat with everybody and just get it over with.
It's sort of like getting Gatling guns before people get away from muskets.
Just ask the people at Gallipoli how well those Gatling guns work.
A little too well.
As for the tech hit from every city, Phil skipped over this part.
Now, I think it would actually be humorous if Madgen read this entire point.
Well, I mean, okay, yes, Madgen has become a legend in his own lifetime, but I'm trying to get
to skip that point.
Problem here is that real nations get a tech boost when they're at war, at least technologically advanced ones. That's when all the innovation comes, you know? That's why we have Jeeps.
Yeah.
No, it's
ballpoint pens, for crying out loud.
The part I was going to highlight was that the tech hit from extra cities doesn't really have an effect on the player's general tech rate, that quote. And I think I actually did say something along that line when Brave New World first came out. Or at least, I think what I actually said was something like, the tech hit isn't a huge thing anymore. I mean, it's there, and it will increase the general tech rate, obviously. But as long as the cities you're taking produce a sufficient amount of beakers, then it's not going to slow you down to take more cities. And to merge it in with, I think, one of the later parts of his question, when to raise versus when to keep. If it's a crappy little city, that's not going to help you burn it down. There's no.
What is the exact percentage now?
Depending on the map size, blah, blah, blah. But on standardized map, it's about 5%.
I mean, that makes sense then. If you keep a good city that's worth it, then it will contribute enough to your tech rate to not have you lose your overall progress rate.
If it's crappy little city and it's not going to get you new luxuries or new strategics, or it's just too small and can't grow, maybe burn it. And you have to remember to burn it down when you get it, not later. Otherwise, the culture and the tech hit sticks.
Good change, too, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, and actually, for the negative diplo modifier, wrapping back up, liberating cities to anybody from anybody does actually reduce your warmonger hate.
Because you're coming in to rescue, you know.
Yeah, so just don't rescue the capital, but if you rescue other cities.
When we liberated Paris, we didn't keep it for ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
Imagine if that happened, you know. France says, oh, thank you for liberating Paris. He said, no, it's ours now. Thank you.
Sorry, we're here. It's ours.
Thanks for the culture boost.
Look, you have a tiny little Statue of Liberty in there, and it's a copyright infringement, so we're entitled to take Paris.
Greasy Dave does say in a follow-up email, because I told him that I was setting this to be discussed on this episode, I don't mind it becoming more difficult, this whole process of warmongering and keeping up the tech and dealing with not being able to trade luxuries for increased happiness. So I'm just curious how different strategies to get it to work. How can I find the right balance between conquered cities to make use of their luxuries, resources, etc., and yet keep myself realistically in the tech rate? And I think as we've already gotten to in this answer, there is no one answer. There are all these different variables that you need to take into account, including difficulty level. And he mentions, I play Immortal comfortably normally, but I'm not good enough player to be able to take on the AI when I'm at a tech disadvantage. And I would say that in the warmongering, a tech disadvantage, strictly speaking, if an AI, let's say they're one era ahead of you, just to keep it simple, as opposed to counting number of technologies. Oh, my gosh. What have they invested in terms of that technology in their units? Have they done the poof magical upgrades? Do they have a lot of units? Where are those units situated? So just because, at least certainly temporarily, if they're at a tech advantage, but you can press the advantage of proximity and by sheer weight of numbers and perhaps cultivating relationships early, which is, hey, they're a technology ahead of us, but perhaps you could get another civilization to join the war with you, or at the very least through the World Congress, cut off their trade, for example, and then you can cripple their ability to respond to the war, and then you've effectively negated their technological advantage.
You know, what Dan is really trying to say is Zerg Rush.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of it.
Zerg Rush.
If you wanted that to be the byline, I guess you could go for it. It's a little simplistic, but okay.
I guess it depends on what type of tech disadvantage. I mean, if it's a, the AI is just ahead of you in tech, that doesn't really matter. They could have all sorts of non-military tech, which might make them great, except if they have the same military techs as you, well, you can just go take their nice, shiny new cities.
Sir, there's an army of spearmen coming at us.
Yeah.
Get out the Gatling guns. There's
300 spearmen approaching the city.
AI is like, hey, I've got archaeologists. What do you have? Big guns. So big gun versus the middle finger? Yeah, I think the big gun's probably going to do more.
Just being able to revisit the places where he had war. You know, he defeated barbarians and, oh, look, there's something there now.
Speaking of there being something there now, there were comments on the last episode.
What?
Everybody loved our airport discussion.
I missed this.
Yeah. What is it, the T Pangolin? How did he say it? That it got hilariously heated. First off, I love your alliteration, number one.
Hold on. Time out. Recap for the people who weren't there.
Oh, that's called episode 185. Go check there.
Just give me the gist.
Become guest hosting guy.
What was the pro and con of this? What was the argument about?
I don't know.
Airports and trade routes, basically. Why don't we have air trade routes, so to speak? Oh.
Yeah, why does not constructing an airport in city, why does it not generate a city connection? Should it or should it not? And then the points within. And there was a definitive line in the sand. And I think for a lot of our listeners, we usually agree with each other, at least in some respects. Maybe we don't have the same points, but hey, you agree, but I agree for a different reason. Oh, okay. But in this case, there was like, yeah, we've taken these points, we've considered both of these points, and we came to a different ultimate conclusion.
Well, it sounds to me that it's a gameplay balance issue. And the way to fix that, if you really wanted to make a mod that has air routes, is basically, as time goes on, the amount of money that you get from land routes and sea routes drops, and the amount of land routes and air routes increase. I mean, that's basically how you have to go with it. That's how it is in real life. I mean, UPS on the ground versus UPS flying, which one costs more? You still need sea routes even today because some cargo is just too huge for a plane.
Yeah, of course, UPS doesn't actually deliver food all over a place or deliver much of anything else other than small, mostly empty boxes.
That actually work, you know, when you're having a food route between cities, the airdrop.
Air's expensive relative to the alternative methods.
Let's put it this way. The only reason why it's not in there is basically because of gameplay issues. I'm pretty sure Firaxis thought of it and wanted to include it, but said, you know what, it's too difficult to figure out.
So well, just Pangolin mentioned, like, you could then just destroy all your roads and rails and not pay maintenance on them and whatnot. And he mentioned that there's a balance of that against the 25% production boost that you get from having cities connected by rail.
True. Well, of course, harbors get it for free. So
not all of your cities are on the coast.
You make your air routes not qualify for city connections.
No, that is the point. Air routes don't qualify for city connections. That's the point in game right now.
Not if you're landlocked.
I guess somebody wanted the air route thing so they could build a city high up in the mountains and have an air connection, kind of like some places in real life. Mm. Cheaper to fly in than to try to build a road up there.
To add to the discussion,
or to at least move away from episode 185, the redo,
perhaps.
T. Pangolin had said that an idea that I had on this point was that trade routes basically graduate by road and then by sea. So if roads and harbors provide city connections, with airports potentially providing them too, then why not allow air trade routes? As you guys said, you don't ship masses of stuff, so perhaps the quantity could be limited of that to a third the yield of a caravan. It might be nice to provide far-flung cities with a small amount of food or hammers for a shorter amount of time, say 10 turns, and will potentially eliminate the pseudo requirement for cities to be built along the coast so as to build a harbor. That's a whole new mechanic, though.
I have an idea for him. Another whole new mechanic, but maybe air routes could be the only way to have foreign city connections. And foreign city connections would give some sort of bonus there.
But we have foreign city connections called caravans. Yeah.
No. Not that kind. I'm talking about that little triangle with the three dots on it. Have that kind, except it's blue instead of yellow or something like that.
Oh, man. Bring back Civ 4 trade routes? I don't know about that.
But we already have trade routes. That's the whole point of these trade units.
It's not trade routes. It is trade. No.
You get money and science and tourism and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, the city connection to me is a more extracted form of a trade route that we have with caravans and cargo ships, where that's a specific route between specific cities for a specific give and take, hammers, food, gold, science, religion, pressure, whereas the city connection is more about, like within your own internal empire, that's goes towards more the nation itself as opposed to like city versus city.
That's just it.
They're both parts of the same thing. Casper GM also chimed in on that point, but there was a couple of other people that had some comments about other things we discussed on that episode. What? We discussed other things.
What?
JB said that he actually enjoyed the episode more than usual, which, you know, might mean that, you know, rather than
hate it, he just
barely tolerating it, tolerated a little bit. I don't know. It's a sliding scale. He said the nerfing archery unit segment was particularly interesting. Perhaps I respect Magin too much, and then winky face, but his affirmation on the subject impressed me. I had been considering rebalancing ranged and siege units, but was going to do it from the other direction, by making siege more powerful versus land units by granting them the bombardment one promotion available to naval ranged units. After the show, I may do both and see if it is doable or overdoes it. And so I said in a follow-up post to let us know how that goes.
Sure.
Captain Oblivious said, I particularly found the discussion on the state of war very interesting. Although I was of a divided mind on the topic, it definitely provided some good insight. One that got touched on that I loved and would like to see implemented was Magin's idea of using armed forces to assert your will and repel settlers. I feel like there were aspects of this that were glanced over, and much of it was hand-waved with the idea that if it's important to you, just declare war.
Okay.
You know, why don't you just declare war and just capture their settler for you? Just be honest about it.
Well, and you see, I didn't think it was so much that we glanced over it. We addressed it, and there's so much of what you want to do in a war, what your goal is, and then whether or not you're able to carry that out is another matter. No war declaration is the same other than the fact that you've declared war. What that looks like in terms of taking cities and or removing units and or pillaging and or using the diplomacy system to get other people to gang up on you, either through active trade declarations or using the World Congress to blockade this, that, and the other ability to make money.
Yeah.
That's all open game. From the YouTube comments, one comment. Please, Spirit 81, PLS, Spirit 81. I always thought maybe you could build siege units in the field, maybe by melee units or workers in reality. A castle siege would work that way. You march your host up to the castle and then build siege units in place.
It's not how they did it. I mean, maybe battering rams, in which you had to actually cut down the tree and just ram it, but no, not siege engines or trebuchets or ballistas or anything like that.
I thought they did build trebuchets on the field sometimes.
Yeah, but you have to bring some stuff with you.
Well, yeah.
You get the wood there, fine, but, you know, all the other parts.
Spend this belief here and say that that's what setting up is.
Yeah, that's exactly what setting up is. Keep in mind, these sieges are going on for years, so in your brain you can think, well, you know, they brought the equipment for it, but they didn't actually have the trebuchet set up yet. So they spent 6 months setting up their trebuchet after a turn goes by, two turns, you know, 6 months, 6 months.
Or like 20 years, you know.
Depending on when you do
really
it.
Really slow builders. They actually sanded the entire thing before they actually got flinging. No, we're going to siege, but we have to do it in style.
That's something that should exist in there, is trying to find a way to get, you know, cities to just capitulate because they have no food. Or just let them all die.
Well, that's what happens during peace treaties. I mean, you know, your overwhelming force, say, listen, leave us alone and we'll give you this city.
No, I'm talking while you're there, because, I mean, if you lock everybody inside a wall and they have no access to food, eventually they either give up or die.
Right, to try to get the AI to recognize that perhaps now might be a time to offer some generous terms so we don't cripple ourselves completely.
Yeah.
have some potential to try to recover?
On a historic scale, because Civ largely operates on a historical scale, not really so much a tactical scale. Like, you would starve out within a much shorter time than what one turn represents for much of the game.
Oh, of course.
So it's hard to really make that mechanic make sense, because you have like the 50 or 100 year starve.
Oh, what
the
heck?
And in Civ terms, if you do it early enough, you could have like hundreds and hundreds of years of starving a city and they wouldn't starve out. Or they would, but it would be imbalanced at that point and you would just starve everyone out.
You do understand that the agricultural tech comes with food replicators, right?
Mm. Well, of course.
So, yeah.
This is alternate history because we've done this at least once.
In the chat, I'm a statue reminds us, I think, and I think we would all agree, game fun versus reality, game fun must win. I mean, I would call that gameplay, but okay, six half dozen of the other.
Yeah, usually.
If you say so.
Captain Oblivious had kind of a pseudo-anger follow-up. I've been listening regularly since the middle of Season 6, but I tend to go back to older episodes and listen to them while I play. And you can thank yourself, so that's me, and Mad Jin for me finding it, between shoutouts you guys have given on Beyond the Monument.
Ha ha.
It's like shoutouts that I gave, probably, but anyway. Have you visited the polycast.net lately? Like that.
Wait a minute. What?
Here we go again.
Which Civ were you playing in your first episode? Which one? Which Civ and which expansion had been just released at that point?
For the first episode of Polycast? Oh, it was shortly after the Warlords expansion for Civ 4 came out.
Okay. So Beyond the Sword.
We've been doing this a while.
I was longer. China in my first game, and I permanently allied with Mackie.
Mackie's being polite. Captain Oblivious also says, and the entertainment you each provided on your respective Minecraft Let's Plays. I just pointed out, I've never done a Minecraft Let's Play, although I've been a part of some Minecraft videos. Maybe in an alternate reality. But he says, keep up the good work, and I expect nothing less. And then we've got kind of I call it the or else smiley. So
besides, we also don't have Minecraft LPs. Polycraft LPs.
I just hope Dan doesn't discover Kerbal Space Program anytime soon.
Somebody on this crew ought to play it so we can watch ourselves fail so badly.
Just to watch your three little astronauts panic. That's always the best part of that game.
Canis Albinus in the chat says, early era polycast is awesome, smiley face. Aw, well, that's good that it's awesome.
Back when you were actually in the Stone Age, you know? Podcast, you know, you had to use a chisel and rock for podcasts.
That's true, we do call the first season of Polycast Classic, so that was the classical era. Oh, what era are we in now, though, is the question.
Not the information age, that's for sure.
Oh, gosh, there's no information on this show. We're never
never.
Canis Albonis says that Polycast is in the industrial era now.
I'm not sure if we're being that industrious, though.
You know what? Here's homework for you for the next couple of weeks, Candace, because I'm a secondary school teacher, so I can do this. Go through our archive of episodes and tell us, like, okay, when did we go from ancient to classical?
And when did you have a renaissance?
Past our renaissance already, ouch, in a way. But
oh, really?
I are curious.
You've gone beyond being awesome.
We're still drafting rifles, though, because that's really effective.
It is.
Captain Oblivious tells us, you don't have to be industrious to be industrial. Maybe you metaphorically went to acoustics first.
Yeah.
We do deal in quite a bit of audio.
Speaking about hot air. Hey, Dan.
Yes!
Well done.
Polycast episode 186. Speaking of hot air. It's a contender. Recorded for episode 175 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Mad Jin, and Mega Bears Fan.
We had a post on Civ Fanatics from user Drew Bell requesting a challenge. The Polycasters choose 5 existing Civs in Civ 5 and change their UA, UU, UB, or UI and discuss how those Civs can be tweaked or completely revamped to be balanced. He wants a particular focus on balance rather than fun, because apparently his idea of fun is just giving Shaka lots and lots of nukes.
That would be fun. He's right.
It's like giving Phil lots of nukes. You know what the result's going to be.
Well, he mentions me directly in this comment, so I mean, whatever.
Oh, okay. That's what TMIT is. All right. There we
yes.
go.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's how they spell Phil on the internet.
This specific Phil is spelled TMIT.
Okay. What do you think? Pick a Civ and make it better.
Oh, man. I don't even know where to start. I mean, he pretty much stole my idea before I even knew it. This was a challenge. So now it's pretty difficult for me.
Yes, but you have to make it balanced.
Oh, right. Well, now, I think we need to give more units the ability to automatically withdraw And who did you give that to? We could give it to the legions.
But how would you make it balanced?
I'm not going to be able to sit here and balance these civs around each other nicely. This is something that would be like legit hard to do. Because right now, there really isn't a lot of balance. Some civs are pretty significantly better than other civs. There's just no way around it. Are we balancing around like the average then? Or are we balancing so that like anything we would make would be comparable to a top tier civ?
From Stas, he says, when, if ever, do you build windmills? And yes, we're talking about Civilization V, brackets, still. They cost twice as many hammers as a workshop, a little more than that. And their 10% bonus only applies to buildings, which you could have built instead of a windmill.
Yeah.
You do know you can actually buy windmills, too.
Crazy thought.
Can do that.
And I would say this thread, you can categorize a lot of the discussion into there's a little favor for windmills, there's some favor for windmills, and there's some great favor for windmills, which is probably like two-thirds little favor, and then the rest of the third is split between some and great. Stas summarizes in post 20, as the consensus seems to be that they aren't worth building all the time. They're mostly useful for their specialist slot, but there are so many more things that are worth building or rushing before them. And honestly, I think situations where it is beneficial to construct the windmill, certainly as compared to other options, or even spending the gold, gets too limited. I agree to leave the windmill as it is, in my opinion. Okay, maybe you have a city that's already heavy on production. You've got enough mined hills, with or without iron, that you can work it. So like a 10% boost to building production is like a meaningful value, practically speaking. Maybe you've constructed a wonder that's giving you great engineer specialists. Okay, so you can have another great engineer specialist you can tack onto that. But quite frankly, the windmill needs help.
I remember back in vanilla, the windmill actually got nerfed. It got switched with the workshop. They did a direct swap between the workshop and the windmill somewhere in there.
You know, this post is interesting, number 20, and there's it's a mistake I commonly see, so I do want to address it. You cannot evaluate a building, unit, or anything else just by the amount of turns it takes to pay back its cost and then start rewarding you with payback. You also have to look at the opportunity cost. If you're building a windmill instead of something else, that means that, yes, the windmill will help you get future buildings a little bit faster once you have it than you would have otherwise, but you are still investing a time into that windmill, and that time could have been spent building another building that gave you more benefit sooner. And in a lot of cases, that opportunity cost is too strong to merit building the windmill, you know, or other buildings or other units, whatever. Well, it continually get pushed back in your priority until it becomes not worth building them.
Yeah.
Every Civ game has buildings that tend to fall into this category.
And the other opportunity cost, just to put that out there, you have to go and settle a city on flatlands to build the windmill in the first place.
Windmill on a city built on hills for you.
Yeah.
Is anyone here build windmills consistently? In other words, are there more situations than not where you would want to invest either the hammers or the gold in a windmill?
I do.
They're not the first building I build for hammers, but
more often than not, Majin.
If I'm making bad decisions and actually putting cities on flatlands, or if they're taken.
No, I love this. If I'm making bad decisions,
yeah, then I might as well. I like production buildings, but yeah, realistically, the windmill cost is just brutally too high. It costs the same amount as a factory, basically. Windmill, factory, it's only one tech away. Like, what are you really going
to
build?
I would say to help the windmill, two things we need to do. One, make it available earlier in the tech tree, because a lot of people say, oh, there's that great engineer specialist. Okay, it's one, but if you made it earlier in the technology tree, so it then has time to generate a more cumulative effect, like, for example, make the windmill available in medieval so it could stack with a workshop, and perhaps even more so, we need to reduce the hammer cost. Like Madjin was saying, look at how much it costs, you know, relative to a factory. So a workshop is available earlier at less than half the cost, and the percentage-based production not only applies to buildings, but everything in that city, and it also gets a great engineer slot, and it also costs the same amount of maintenance.
Isn't that just a workshop?
But wait, windmills predated workshops. I mean,
no, we have water mills for that.
Depends what you define as a workshop.
Yeah. Workshops come at metal casting, so.
Yeah, okay.
Moving the windmill and basically calling it Workshop 2.0 probably isn't the best plan if you want to make it better.
No one's forcing you to build these things, by the way, just so you know.
Still, it does hurt to have options in the game that are so consistently not useful that they might as well not exist.
Well, if I could count all the times in which I had nothing, literally nothing to build in a city, because everything's been built, so I don't think that's a problem.
On Dan's point of what to do with it, keeping in mind that if you build a city on the hill, you get plus one production in the city. Yeah. So you've already got half the windmill's power without actually having to waste a bunch of hammers.
How about giving a windmill a nice little bonus when it's on a hill or in a city with hills?
Well, you're not allowed to build it in the first place on a hill.
Well, that's silly because that's what they actually do in Holland.
There's things that can be done, probably like even just cutting the hammer cost in half, giving it a better bonus versus buildings, or just more base production, even double it up to four. So you have a choice between four base production with Flatland City or put it on a hill and actually have city defense. Either way, it would make it more of an interesting choice.
I contributed positively to the discussion. Now let me contribute not positively to this discussion. Let's make it so that in order to build a windmill, you have to construct a workshop first.
Oh, dear.
How about the other way around?
If you made it that far, then it's pretty rich toast. Did anybody build zoo or stadiums?
I do, when I have a severe happiness hit.
Is this before or after Brave New World?
At taxpayer expense.
Wait, yeah. What?
Yeah, you know it's taxpayer expense? People unhappy. If you have no luxury resources near you, you better get those zoos and stadiums up real quick.
Yep. Although they only work with, like, you know, local happiness. Don't overexpand. But otherwise, yeah. Basically, if you have problems with your happiness, as in you have a lot of population and not enough happiness to deal with it, yes, you build zoos and stadiums because you need to. Do they suck hammer or gold per happiness point? Yes, but you still got to do it.
Well, that's a choice, I think. Let's start with zoos here. Post-Brave New World, with ideologies, you look at pretty well any one of the ideological, a level one tenet, and the amount of local happiness that you can get from adopting those policies.
Well, I said when you have no happiness. Yes, if you have an ideology and you're swimming in happiness, then no, you don't waste your hammers on zoos and stadiums, because you should be building stuff other than that, because, hey, opportunity cost.
Oh, you weren't making that clear, Matt.
Only I did. Units. I said it right off the beginning. You just weren't listening.
No, I heard you when you said you don't have any happiness, and I'm saying—
So you ignored it.
No. You said we don't have any happiness. You didn't talk about ideologies at all. So I didn't know if you were even taking that into account when you said that.
Well, if you have ideologies and you don't have happiness, then you've already spent your ideological happiness on something else. Huh?
There, now you've said it out loud and not just thinking it. I can't read your mind, thankfully.
I can, so there. Guess what he's thinking about you, Dan? You don't want to know.
See, just saying that is worse than actually, you know, making something up, because you know my mind is going to make it much, much worse than it probably actually is. So yeah, thanks for that, Jonah.
Yeah.
He was wondering if top players build zoos or stadiums. They cost an ungodly amount of hammers and seem not to be worth it.
Again, unhappy, build it. How come I always want freedom, but it always says, screw freedom, it's time to have a slave state. You know, they should swap some of those around, because the things that order are the things I want, and freedom doesn't have anything I want. Sucks.
I think you're becoming too emotionally attached to the label of the ideology.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you have to remember that in Civ 4, slavery was the best civic for most of the game that you would actually matter. Yeah, and Civ 5 is nothing by comparison in terms of how evil you want to be for pretty much the entire game. Don't worry about it. It's all relative.
Civ will never match the evilness of Alpha Centauri, the level of evilness that you could have.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
It was delicious in that regard. But
stapling.
Oh, nothing. The self-aware city is frightening as hell.
Yeah, being unhappy actually sucks even more now, given that for every point of unhappiness, you lose 1% of gold and production now. And if you hit negative 10, you get rebels. So if you want your people to be happy and therefore not screw with you, yes.
Crush the rebel scum.
As long as you've exhausted all other sources of happiness, of course.
That, yes.
Why don't they combine the stadium and the zoo? And you could have animals death fighting, or at least let them see nature in action, you know? Put a couple of giraffes and lions in an arena and see what happens.
They already put the zoo in the theater anyway, so it's cheaper than a stadium.
Oh my gosh, a stadium. Yeah, 500 hammers for plus two happy, which you get from a zoo for 200. You should at least get more than plus two. And even then, that's pretty situational.
I never build stadiums until I see my happiness is at one or two, basically. It's at zero, I get panicked.
Like, to me, at Civ 5 right now, stadiums are to happiness what medical labs are still to food. So situational in the modern era. Oh my gosh, no.
Who needs medical labs anyway?
No, we don't need to prevent that contagion or anything.
No. Oh, another city got infected in my pandemic game.
I could see zoos, since they come in the Renaissance era, so before you get too industrial, I could see situations where you might want them as a stopgap before you could adopt an ideological tenet that will give you happiness. In which case, at that point, if you choose your ideology correctly, and what I mean by that is, I look at my empire, I need happiness, and I need a lot of happiness right now. What one should I choose? You could probably then go and get rid of your zoos, and then you're no longer paying the maintenance for that.
We have a comment on Reddit from Jedi Time Lord. Okay, that's mixing two science fiction things I don't even want to think about. And he talks about a common sense Civ 5 issue that he's never seen discussed. He says, why can't I start producing something, then hurry up with gold, however much I haven't produced yet? They did this in 3 and 4, and now I don't think it makes any sense from developers. Move it, especially considering you can just buy things outright. For example, if an archer costs 200 gold or 40 hammers, I don't know this number offhand, I should be able to work on it for 30 hammers and then buy it immediately for 50 gold. Has anyone else desired this? By the way, I think you answered asked and answered the question right there.
Yeah.
I mean, thing is that units are cheaper in Civ 5 relative to hammers than they were in the previous two games. That's number one. And also, yeah, I liked it in Master of Orion 2 when I half finished something and I could just pay for the rest in gold. But in this case, it's a gameplay balance issue, I'm pretty sure.
And I wouldn't say that they removed it. They just didn't add it to the Civ 5 code.
The one thing that annoys me, but I now understand, is that you just can't simply transfer hammers to a new project. You know, say you're working on this and, oh, I want to work on this now. Can't do that anymore. Those hammers go bye-bye.
It's been many years since you could do that.
I'm just saying you could do it.
Yeah, in Civ 3.
Exactly.
Okay, yes, since Civilization 5 came out through Brave New World, the developers removed a lot of the gold from the map that you could get very early on. They also made it so that you can't say, hey, would you like this resource for 200 gold? Instantly declare war. Now it has to be, you know, gold per turn. You need to get caravans or cargo ships and be able to protect those routes, construct those units, etc., etc. But if you are able to not just buy anything and everything outright from the start of the game, unlike in Civ 4 when you had to adopt universal suffrage, right?
Yes. And it sucked until you had towns.
If you had it so that gold could also be used as a substitution for partial production as well as production. Okay, can I troll this at the extreme? Venice? Okay, excluding Venice, which is the
the trolliest gold Civ of all.
Because I could see someone saying, well, then you just go and tweak Venice. Like, what's the big deal? To me, this is about making a choice that, yes, you want players to have choices, but you also want there to be the potential for consequences for choices. Oh, I really should have started producing this a little sooner, but I'll just go ahead and rush it with gold. And I'm talking about a unit here as opposed to a building, because, of course, you know, you can't. I've already built a theater. Let's build a theater again. No. I can't just buy it with gold. Okay, I need to rush production. Can I go on production focus? Even if I result in a little starvation here for a couple of turns, that's okay. I really need this. I need to push this out, or I need to move some other units back, or another city starts to need to produce a unit. To me, it just becomes a too many options in a way that it's too easy to say, oh, well, it doesn't matter as much what I did do or I didn't do. I can cover my ass too easily, and I think that's why it's not in here.
You know what? Listening to you, Dan, I think the next expansion should be Civ 5. A million is a statistic. Just starve your people. Starve your people to build this granary. We don't care.
But you can starve them for a future. You're not going to necessarily lose population right away.
You're still denying them food.
Well, the trade-off is it's like, hey, you starve for a few turns and then you can actually maybe continue to live as opposed to a whole bunch of you getting wiped out when the city gets captured because you didn't have that short-term pain for long-term gain. And yes, I'm talking about gameplay, not realism, before anyone sends me hate mail.
Dan, merciless autocrat with some pragmatism. Just starve them for a while. They don't care. They're virtual.
Don't try to flatter me, sir.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, long listeners to the show are like, I remember when Dan was a builder before he became such a warmongering bastard.
Yeah, you made me go to Reddit. People are calling me on Reddit. I'm like, stuff is happening. We're arguing. Go get mad.
The reason nobody else is really saying anything on this topic is because they don't want to actually say out loud that they agree with me.
Oh, I agree with you. I just...
Thank you.
I'm just pissed off you said it before I did. That's all.
And it is possible for your opinions to be correct, and that's when they are the same as my own opinions.
And that's when the universe seems a little less stable.
Well, I wasn't very stable to begin with, so I don't really think that's much of a concern.
Oh, you belong at a stable. I'm sorry. I don't actually mean that. I just needed to say it. You couldn't.
Whoa.
You couldn't let me say that without jumping right in there with that, even if it was true or not.
The president's gaming guy tells us that educational games fascinate Obama, and I'm just like, oh, okay. You may find it hard to believe that the leader of the free world...
Gasp.
I paused for no reason whatsoever.
Sorry, I had a little cough there.
Yeah.
Apparently, you may find it hard to believe that Barack Obama, the president of the United States, has much time for video games. But the senior advisor for digital media at the White House, Mark Deloria, says Barack Obama has taken a personal interest in games and gaming culture. I wouldn't have this job if he wasn't interested. He apparently is a veteran gamer who has held senior leadership positions at Google, Sony, Nintendo, and others.
Yeah, he's a veteran gamer.
So just remember, when that Halo guy teabags you, it might be President Obama.
Yep.
You know, the thing is that he did grow up in an era in which video games are booming, so it's not that hard to imagine.
Yeah. Keep in mind, he's got a lot of Republicans constantly trying to say that the video game did it.
The good thing about Civ is that you can just save your game progress, and when you get back in, you instantly know what's going on. It's not like one of those games that, oh, wait, what was I doing? Oh, right. No. You see what's happening, so good for like 5-minute bursts, you know? Oh, shoot, I was attacking China? Oh, wait, I shouldn't tell the premier that. Maybe it takes out his frustrations in Civ. Oh, yeah. Take that, Poland.
Deloria has been working at the White House for 7 months, which he describes as a far more formal environment than Silicon Valley. Did that really need to be said?
You think?
Some people do play games in the White House. I'm trying to find those people and collect them, Pokemon style. Okay. All right, I laughed. I admit, I laughed. I'm not feeling the love for strategy gaming with that statement, but I still thought it was fun.
Strategy right and now, Pokemon.
He says, it hasn't been easy to recruit austere government officials for a gaming session, but he is dead set on getting a group together to play Civilization once a week. I point out that they are playing Candy Crush.
Whoa.
What? No.
Pokemon I can accept, but Candy Crush? Please turn in your gamer badge and hang your head in shame.
What's Candy Crush?
I was at New York Games Conference a couple of weeks ago, and among all the discussion, everybody was talking about Candy Crush. And basically because people were making a crap ton of money with it. That's basically why.
The latest ad, like hot pants.
Ugh. I'll play my Angry Birds.
Now, Deloria mentions that his third favorite educational game is Minecraft, where he says, quote unquote, everyone plays this game. Well, I think it's more accurate to say that everyone should play this game. Not everyone is actually playing
it. I'm not even sure if everybody should play the game. I'm not even sure if that's a statement that should be.
I would play the game, except it's too much of a time sink. Sorry. Way too much of a time sink.
Says the person who plays Civ.
Yeah, I don't play. I don't. You know what? I no longer play Civ until 4 in the morning anymore. You know, I actually just play an hour and then I get this nagging sense that I should stop playing. You ever get that nagging sense in which you're playing, and all of a sudden, actually, you know, my internal clock says, and it's not because you have to pee. I mean, you just decide to stop playing, like, okay, enough for now. I have to do other shit.
Biological functions interrupting more games of Civ than you realize.
No, that's called aging. Deloria says, concerned about violence in games, but doesn't necessarily subscribe to the belief that they promote aggressive behavior. This is the person who's writing for VentureBeat. Deloria says, quote, I think there is a slight inclination to a slight amount of aggression, quote unquote. So in other words, purely speculative and subjective.
All games are competitive. The thing is that some are more abstract than the other. I mean, look at Monopoly. You know, you're trying to bankrupt someone else, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of an abstract concept. When you play a war game, you know, one of those like Axis and Allies, you're having soldiers shooting and killing each other, but you don't actually see it. In a video game, they're actually able to depict it that a board game can't. How many non-competitive games do you know of?
Minecraft.
No, you can have competitive in Minecraft.
You can. Doesn't mean you have to.
It isn't by design, for sure.
But this is my favorite quote from this person. But if the problem thinks it's a problem, that's a problem for the games industry.
What?
Delora, if you describe something as a problem, then by definition, it is a problem whether it thinks it's a problem or not. That's like saying a proof is a proof.
Is a proof. Don't forget the third one.
And when you have a good proof, it's because it's proven.
What if we defined him as a problem?
There's also a petition to try to get the Obama and the U.S. administration to play Civ because I like how it's phrased. If the president and his staff are capable of governing effectively, it should be no challenge to them to play Civilization V from beginning to end and lead their chosen civilization to victory. But people who started this petition, that assumes that a government is capable of being effective.
Hee-hee, U.S. government effective. Lol, you make funny.
Canada, they're free healthcare, making us look bad.
Yeah, see, the difference is that in-game, you could just kill your rebels. Whereas, it would be hard to explain in reality that half of Congress died. Oops. Oh well. Here, have a zoo.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
This is way off topic, but I miss I Am Weasel!
Oh, God.
IR Baboon.
You're like dating yourself with that, as sad as that sounds.
It's the mid-90s!
Exactly. That's a long time ago now.
I'm much older than that.
People have been like born and grow up since then.
Hey.
Someone who's born in the early 90s can legally drink alcohol in the United States now.
Hey, I watched episodes of The Jeffersons, so shut up.
You know that you start to be old when listening to a radio station and the decade that you were in high school is now referred to as classic.
That is
a sure sign that you are old, sir.
You mean they play Nirvana on classic rock stations now?
The early 2000s are considered classic radio now, too. Yeah,
it's pretty sad.
Okay, I know. I got it. Dan?
Yes.
Star Trek The Next Generation is 26 years old now.
No, don't remind us.
We're like 101 or 102 ATMIT, right?
Maybe it's nuclear age and you're just blowing up.
And before that, we had BTMIT.
What?
We're not going to measure in relation to how long you have or have not been on the show.
Okay, I am lost like a Bedouin in a sandstorm right now.
Okay.
Still I was just fine. Being a jerk, don't mind me.
Grew up and actually managed to show up. I know.
Wow.
Well, it took him 100 episodes to grow up, so, you know.
I didn't grow up. What are you talking about?
I was going to say, what are you talking
just
about?
Older.
Oh, that's true. I did get older.
Fella's the Peter Pan of the show.
Flashing back to Mitt Romney singing Who Let the Dogs Out, trying to impress a kid. It's like, that's from the mid-90s, Mitt. Shut up. To quote, forgot the comedian, it's like when Bob Hope puts on a leather jacket and acts like Fonzie.
Mm.
No, that kind of labeling is like I heard on the news this week that some researchers have been looking at 8 to 18-year-olds and their spinal development, and because they're hunched over so many consoles so often that it's actually affecting their physical development and they're getting particularly a lower back pain. So they call it Game Boy Back.
What?
I thought, Game Boy, oh my gosh, what decade are you in?
In Game Boys, you don't have to be hunched over.
Oh, I thought.
They mean it literally, isn't that this person is a Game Boy. And so he is hunched over too much. It's all relative, though, because my back was pretty good until, you know, I injured it in lifting a television. So, hey.
You know, they don't call carpal tunnel syndrome typing of the dead syndrome. You know that, right?
Oh, you were trying to lift a television. You were trying to play a video game, weren't you, Phil? So it was the game's fault that you lifted the television and hurt your back. See, games are root of all evil.
I wasn't even doing something that would result in my enjoyment of it afterwards.
No. Don't use logic. No.
Does anybody ever call it the Internet Information Superhighway anymore? Just wondering.
I think
Al Gore had, you know, all the claim on using that phrase.
Oh, Al Gore can say that. He invented the thing anyway. So
yes, but now he's charging you
$500.
It's tubes! Say it on
your podcast. All the tubes!
Well, hey, when I'm a leader, I accept people believing that I'm a god. I don't know what his problem is.
Living for 6,000 years, that little assumption does start to rise.
Yeah.
I'm not a god. I'm just a mutant, okay?
I'm just immortal and all-powerful.
Well, not all-powerful.
We'll see about that by the end of history.
The end of history apparently is the year 2100.
Not if I can help it.
Nope. The end of history is the end of this episode.
You want me to do an exit? I have no idea what to say.
Except yeah, Dan's trying to say this episode's history.
We'll see you guys. Well, you, I won't see you, actually. You'll be seeing them. Probably won't be seeing me. There's Daniel here. Daniel Quick, who, by the way, occasionally is part of the TD Gaming Podcast. He used to be a regular. Now he just guest stars.
It should be no challenge to listen to an episode of Polycast from beginning to end and lead your given ears to pleasure.
Ooh, you're going to tongue my cochlea? You're tonguing my cochlea, huh? We have Mad Gin.
All right, let's get this over with.
Oh, that was his statement. The mage who needs caffeine. Makla.
No. Wow, that
yes,
was...
Nobody's mispronounced it in ages.
Yes.
It was very close, though, honestly.
And the Mian team.
I'll be a good god for you guys, I swear.
Right.
And I am the soon-to-be-departed Jonah Falcon, who you won't be hearing from for a long time, I imagine. I want them to wear the clothes of their current era. You know, if it's the modern era, I want Attila the Hun in a suit.
Yeah.
You want shaved bald Joan of Arc with the army t-shirt again?
That was kind of cool when they were doing that, like in Civ 3. Still, I would rather them put all their effort into gameplay optimization before they do things like that.
At this point, I'd pay for an expansion that gave us that. So long as it came with two more Civs, you know, I'm not. Something like that.
Oh, coming in January 2014, Civilization V DLC. Attila, now in a suit.
Yeah, well, I mean, relative. I mean,
suit up.
Wouldn't you like to see George Wash in one of those Fred Flintstone outfits?
That was a really fast topic. I'll bet this next one can be even faster. I mean, if Mackie starts.
Yeah, she's actually on this podcast. You know?
Oh, I am? Wait, I'm just not listening to this and just stuff? What?
Is this live?
I understand why Mackie fell asleep, because she heard me talking and it allowed
sleep. No, it's actually Mansion that puts me to sleep sometimes. I'll listen to one of the LPs here and I'll just kind of start drifting off.
You know, if they go from a caravan to a truck, why not just have the civilization leaders? Because I'm tired of seeing Attila the Hun in the year 2013 still wearing that outfit of his, riding around, you know, or...
It's retro.
Actually...
You could always push it later and call it a winter bind.
Yeah, but then what's the point?
Oh, jeez. No. Then you'll have happiness problems in your city. Oh, no, wait. That's realism.
And,
sorry.
And Don Quixote will have nothing to go after. I mean...
Yeah, that is true.
I'm lacking in common. C-N-T-S.
Wait, did you say C-N-T-S?
C-E-N-T-S.
Oh, I didn't hear the E.
Well, C ran together.
It's just abbreviating it. Don't worry about it.
C-E-N-T-S. It's not my fault that C and E both have the same last sound. C. C-E. C.
Let's continue.
Moving forward.
It's just... This is like a minefield now.
Yeah.
He's the first hipster. He's being deliberately ironic.
He'll probably shower and then soil himself to that degree just so he's the right amount again.
No. No. When you say soil yourself, I think of a different kind of soiling yourself.
Yeah. Totally accidental word choice. Just, yeah, totally.
Totally deliberate.
I didn't mean to do that. Nope.
Was it once again a crappy word choice?
My goodness, you guys and gal are enjoying this tangent too much. Let me quash it for you. Drag. All leaders in drag. You're welcome. Moving on.
No, that sounds fun, actually.
Let's start this slightly again. Reintroduce me like you did, Jonah, and then pause, and I will say something, and then you can introduce somebody else.
Daniel Quick, who is here, and I'm not going to let him talk.
It should be no challenge. It should be no challenge. I'm going to jam this in here.
I really did?
Whether we want it or not, just fit it in there.
Recording November 2nd, 2013. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.